My name is Dr. Andy Wakefield. I'm an academic gastroenterologist who qualified in London in 1981. My principal interests are inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, and ulcerative colitis, and that led me into the field of autism in 1995, and particularly regressive autism, where parents had, in many cases, claimed that their child, their normally developing child, had regressed after exposure to a vaccine.
And then you, Dr. Todd?
My name's Jim Todd. I'm professor of pediatrics, microbiology and epidemiology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine and the Colorado School of Public Health. My training is in infectious diseases that obviously includes vaccines in preventing infectious diseases and the safety of vaccines.
And Kathy, if you'll share your credentials.
My name is Kathy Lozapone, and I'm a postdoctoral researcher in the Molecular, Cellular, and Developmental Biology Department at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And my primary interest is in the types of bacteria that live in the human gut and how they affect our health.
And you also have another interest in our topic today, which is autism, vaccinations, and autism again. What is the link that you're curious about regarding autism and microbes?
There has been a growing body of evidence for an association between gastrointestinal disorders and autism, and so I'm interested in how the microbial community in the gut changes in people with autism versus healthy people.
Let's start this discussion by going straight to the biggest controversy surrounding it, and that involves Dr. Wakefield. Dr. Wakefield, you have been formally discredited in your country of birth, England, regarding some of your research and some of your efforts regarding autism and a link to possibly vaccination. Is that correct?
Well, I think you've just heard a colleague describe that the evidence for a gastrointestinal association with autism is growing, and that was the association that we first introduced into this field, the discovery of a novel inflammatory bowel disease, and that most certainly has not been discredited. Indeed, it's been replicated around the world.
Yes, that part has been replicated in different ways, the gut gastrointestinal link. But just so that we set the record straight, much of your work, some of your work regarding autism and looking at possible triggers for it, including vaccinations, has been discredited formally in England.
No, again, the work has not been discredited. The attempt has been made to discredit me personally, but not the work, not the science.
All right, so you would say that you have been personally discredited or publicly personally discredited.
Yes, what has happened to me is what happens to any doctor who questions policy or profit in this case. My interest is not anti-vaccine. My interest is vaccine safety. My interest is a vaccine safety first agenda. And I'm entirely in favor of that. And that is what should be the priority. And I don't think anyone can really argue with that vaccine safety should be an absolute priority. And our job as physicians at the time in 1995 was to respond to parental concerns.
And so, Dr. Todd, do you want to share your opinion of Dr. Wakefield and his research and why vaccinations are important to you?
I'm happy to share my opinions about vaccine safety and why vaccines are incredibly important to give the children in Colorado. I think I'm perfectly happy for Dr. Wakefield to discuss the issues between him and the General Medical Council. I think it's far more important, though, not to be discussing those as much as talking about the principal issue, which is, are vaccines safe? And they are, and our children should be getting them, and I'm very happy to discuss that.
Do you want to give a quick summary of your opinion of Dr. Wakefield's work to date?
Well, again, I don't think this should be about Dr. Wakefield. I think it should be about the theory that MMR vaccine is somehow associated with autism, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. It's very important to have an evidence-based discussion, and I think it's very clear that the evidence has shown that theory that Dr. Wakefield advanced is not correct. And the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine is not associated with an increased risk of autism. And in fact, the evidence currently is that it may be associated with a decreased incidence of autism.
Kathy, do you want to respond to any of this at this point?
I am familiar with Dr. Wakefield's original paper and some of the subsequent studies that have been done in the field. The initial work was based on 12 individuals, 8 of whom had reported, I guess, within 2 weeks having had the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, whereas the subsequent research has involved case-controlled studies with thousands of children and did not show an association. I believe there's about 20 research papers that now have a differing opinion.
Well, let me just come back to what my colleagues have said, because I actually take exception to the idea that the studies have been negative. Let me quote you one. That is Dr. DeStefano's study from the Centers for Disease Control, and this looked at the age of MMR vaccination and autism risk, and it found a clear statistically significant association between younger age at vaccination and risk of autism. And when they looked at the most recently vaccinated children, that risk was in the order of increased by 230%. And that, I believe, is because vaccination age, the age at which children receive the MMR, has come down over time to around 12 months. So here we have a study that in the public relations arena has been portrayed as negative, but in fact tested an a priori hypothesis which was positive.
Dr. Todd, do you want to respond to that?
There's been a lot of conversation about individual aspects of individual studies, but I think it's been properly represented that the preponderance of evidence by far is that MMR specifically and vaccines in general are not associated with an increased risk of autism. We can't take one study out of context of all other studies. In fact, the entire process of science is to learn more and more with improved study technologies.
Dr. Todd, are you suggesting that for me to tell which studies are better than the others, I should just count the studies and count how many studies are out there and whichever has the most studies behind it wins?
Not at all. That would be the converse of what I'm saying. It is perfectly fine to have a theory or an hypothesis. Dr. Wakefield put that forward in his paper. The next part of that process is to test it scientifically in different ways. Evidence has to be weighed, and the quality of evidence is very important, not just the numbers of papers that are done. In fact, the numbers of papers also supports the conclusion, as well as the quality of the studies, that autism is not associated with MMR vaccine.
That certainly is the general consensus among researchers that I have talked to, but I'm curious if you're aware of the study that Dr. Wakefield just mentioned and what your opinion is about that one.
I actually can't comment on individual pieces of that study that have been taken out unless it's in front of me and I can look at it. I certainly can say that I have seen in this discussion a lot of pieces of studies that have been cherry-picked to try to support a particular theory. My whole point is that we should not be advocating for theories as reason for changing our behavior. We should be advocating for good science to help learn about autism. And I feel in this area, in the scientific community, looking at the quality and the quantity of work, the evidence is overwhelming that MMR vaccine is not a cause of autism.
Before we look at that more closely, Dr. Wakefield, it's my understanding that vaccinations are just one part of the issues that you have and the concerns that you have about how we deal with autism. You're especially concerned about the health of our digestive tract and how that might tie in with autism.
Absolutely. I mean, this is how we came to it as gastroenterologists, that the parents would say, my child has terrible gastrointestinal problems, and I believe they're related to their autistic behavior. Now, when we investigated the children, they did indeed have a mild to moderate inflammatory bowel disease. But the link came when we treated that bowel disease with the sort of medication that you would use to treat Crohn's, that is, for example, an anti-inflammatory agent. Not only did the bowel symptoms get better, but the behavioral symptoms improved as well.
And so far, you haven't mentioned vaccines as a key element of what your investigation was. It's part of it, but it's not the whole picture of what you're looking at when it comes to autism and possibly a gut health link. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. We're much more interested in the broad picture and trying to help, decide how to help these children for the future, to take a disease which was historically untreatable and lifelong and say, no, it's not. Actually, there is a hugely reversible element to this, but we need to treat it as a medical problem and understand it from a medical perspective.
That is your perspective on autism. And then for the clarification for our audience, Dr. Todd, are you an expert on autism, or is your focus and concern vaccination?
I don't take care of children with autism unless they have an infectious disease problem, and then I do. On the other hand, I've been very active within the autism community. I recognize it as a very important area where we need more research. Parents who have children with autism need answers that the medical community can't entirely provide. To come back to the gut health issue in the original study that you're asking, though, I think it brings up a very important point. When we advocate for theories, that has consequences. And I think one of the examples is chelation therapy, which emerged from the whole idea that somehow the thimerosal or mercury compound as a preservative in vaccines, somehow that was the cause of autism. This led to people advocating for chelation therapy, which the FDA has just now put out an advisory that people advocating for chelation therapy should not be marketing for it because it has proven to be harmful for some children with autism. It just points out the problem with taking a theory and representing it as a fact. And that has been harmful. First consequence is in the general population, people are afraid to vaccinate their children because they've heard this theory. And secondly, parents of children with autism gravitate then to therapies generated around those theories that are disproven or unproven and may prove harmful to their children. That's not the kind of help that families with autism need.
Let me interject two details. One is a fact that, Dr. Wakefield, after your research was given a lot of press in the United Kingdom, vaccination rates went from 90% for MMR, measles, mumps, rubella, down into the 80% level. Whether that's a consequence of what you said directly or the media explanations and interpretations of what you said is up for debate, but that is a direct consequence of some of the research that you did.
No, may I absolutely correct? This is a very, very important point, and I'll dwell on it for a moment. What I did before making any recommendation about vaccination was to read every single paper that had ever been published in pre-licensing studies of measles-containing vaccines, including MMR vaccine. And I wrote a 250-page report on that analysis. And I decided that the studies of measles MMR vaccine were derisory compared to those particularly of the single vaccines. And I said, if I'm asked this question by the media, then I cannot continue to advocate for the use of MMR vaccine. I will strongly advocate for the use of the single vaccines, which I did. Now, at that time, the single vaccines were available in the UK, and there was no problem. Parents could go and get that if they were genuinely concerned. What happened unilaterally is that the government, 6 months after I made that recommendation, withdrew the importation license for the single vaccines. That's when measles came back, and it was therefore the government that was wholly responsible for the resurgence of measles.
All right, Dr. Wakefield, then you are suggesting that there would not have been such a reduction in vaccination rates in the United Kingdom if an option of having a single shot had been available, but it really wasn't available in the United Kingdom after the government responded to your concerns about a multiple vaccination by saying, let's not have single vaccinations in the United Kingdom.
Yes, that's exactly what happened. The MMR rate came down, but what they did not measure was the uptake of the single vaccine. There was a corresponding uptake, a huge uptake in the use of the single vaccine, which was not factored into the equation. The government then removed the option for use of that single vaccine, and therefore we were left with low MMR uptake rates and the resurgence of measles.
Can you quickly explain why you feel it might be important for susceptible children to have single vaccines instead of a multiple one?
Well, my concern, and this is a biological concern, is that when you put different viruses into the same mix, what you produce is a phenomenon called viral interference. The immune response to the viruses is not the same as if you were giving them individually. Now, the implications of this for safety have never been properly studied. It was observed as early as 1969 when they first put MMR together as a single vaccine. It was considered to be an irritation that meant they had to increase or decrease the amounts of the individual viruses in the vaccine. But the implications for safety were never adequately studied.
Dr. Todd, could you respond to that? What is your sense of whether a parent has their child have three vaccines all at once in one shot, or three separate vaccines at separate times?
This has been carefully studied. The issue is when you combine vaccines, and we have lots of combination vaccines, and it's always studied to see, does the combination of vaccines give you the kind of immune response in the child that will protect them against the disease? And the evidence is in MMR that it does. Dr. Wakefield advocated, and I think it's important to emphasize, that he's not telling us that vaccines are bad. He said that he is advocating for single vaccines. And it turns out that more recent studies have shown a couple of things. Number one, the Cochrane Review Group, which is the preeminent evidence-based medicine group in the world, we're talking about evidence-based rather than hypothesis-based medicine. And they concluded in 2005 that there is no credible evidence that links MMR to autism. More recent studies have shown that in fact getting the MMR vaccine reduces the risk of autism, and even more so than the single measles vaccine. So even if you separate the measles vaccine out, it reduces the risk of autism, but the combined vaccine reduces it even more.
You know, there is some evidence that if a child gets a single vaccine, there's always a tiny risk of infection each time a child gets a shot because it pokes through the skin and into the blood system. And so having less frequent vaccines might reduce infections by having multiple vaccines. That's one point of view. Then there are those who agree with Dr. Wakefield that single vaccines create less of an inflammatory load on the body overall. And if someone has some problems with their inflammation, then maybe that will be kinder to the body. These are supported by different kinds of evidence. Dr. Todd, you say the evidence is weak for saying a single vaccine is better. Dr. Wakefield, you say that it's actually relatively strong. Dr. Todd, I'm curious, does it really matter to you which kind of vaccination a parent gets as long as they get their vaccinations for their child?
No, not at all. The key thing that we can say is that vaccines have reduced the risk of hospitalization, of serious illness, even of death, of brain injury dramatically in Colorado. When people stop getting vaccines, even in the United States, even in the last few years, there's risk of acquiring those diseases and having those kinds of injuries. So the important thing is that people get their vaccines on time. The evidence in Colorado is that most of these diseases are going to affect very young children. The problem with saying, well, let's all get individual shots. We already know there are a number of vaccines that kids need to get. It's hard enough to get those in the time frame in the younger age group where it's really necessary. To space them out, if you could do it and still get adequate protection, would be a theory that should be tested. It has not. We have the evidence for combination vaccines and the current vaccine schedule. It works. We know that the risk is really in the youngest children. So deferring vaccinations into some more expanded schedule does put them at risk of getting those diseases when they're young.
When you say the youngest children, how young does the risk develop? Does it make sense for children to have vaccines when they're born or when they're 12 months old? Because there's a disease risk at that point, or is it, from a public health standpoint, most efficient to give the vaccines then?
The vaccine schedule is designed to reflect when the risk is. So, for instance, the Haemophilus influenzae vaccine is given very early because that's the greatest risk of meningitis. It's been incredibly successful. My whole profession is taking care of very sick children with infections. I can't tell you what a dramatic difference that vaccine has made, but it needs to be given early. The pertussis vaccine, similarly, children still die in the United States of whooping cough, of pertussis. That vaccine helps to decrease that disease very significantly. It has to be given early. So delaying vaccination does put those kids at risk until they do get their complete vaccination series.
Dr. Wakefield, do you want to respond on what you agree with and then what you disagree with?
Well, I don't think there's any disagreement between Dr. Todd and I about the merits of vaccination. It's about the safety profile that is particularly of concern to me. And Dr. Todd quoted the Cochrane Review as being the gold standard Cochrane Review. That same review said that the safety studies of the combination MMR, both pre- and post-licensing, were largely inadequate. particularly compared with the safety studies of the single vaccine. Now, there is a position from the Gold Standard Review that advocates the position that I took, that it is entirely reasonable to offer parents the option of a single vaccine, and indeed, the safety profile of the single vaccine is likely to be better than it is for the combination MMR.
Now, Dr. Wakefield, from a practical point of view, can a parent get in all of the vaccines if they do them one at a time?
Well, again, this is a public health issue. I am not concerned about the merits of this vaccine for the purpose of this debate. What I'm concerned about is the safety studies that have been done. Now, a parent might reasonably expect that the safety of the schedule, that is what children will receive, say, up to the age of 4 years, their preschool boosters, might have been tested prospectively. It may have been tested what actually happens in the real world for the cumulative effect or the additive effect of these vaccines. That has never been done. And that is, to me, extraordinary as a parent, not only as a professional, but as a parent. Why has the safety of the schedule never been subjected to any kind of examination?
Dr. Todd, would you please respond to that?
The safety of the schedule is well studied. This idea that the Cochrane Review was advocating for getting single vaccines is not accurate. They did not do so. They basically reviewed all the safety information, and some of it was not as well studied as it should have been. I would agree with that. That has certainly changed. And we know for giving these vaccines to hundreds of thousands of children that they are safe and they are effective. And when we talk about safety, we have to talk about what is the safety of advocating to not get vaccines or to change the vaccine schedule.
Now, I'm not hearing Dr. Wakefield say don't get vaccines. So
no, he seems to be advocating for this single vaccine hypothesis. And we've already discussed the issue of, well, then how do you get those in to young children in a timely fashion with multiple jabs, as they would say in the UK? How do you do that? That's an hypothesis. It could be tested. It hasn't been. Until it has been tested, then we shouldn't be advocating for that as something that parents should embrace.
But I hear you both saying that if a parent is uneasy for any reason about multiple vaccinations, you would both like them to figure out a way to get all of those shots in as single shots then. That would actually be okay with you as long as the parents get their children vaccinated.
Yes, but I strongly disagree with Dr. Todd that it's okay for the public health authorities to introduce a policy, which means that they get all these vaccines and then say after the event that this has not been compared with giving the individual vaccines. That is the responsibility of public health to do those studies before they license the policy, the strategy, rather than afterwards. It has not been done, and the question that I'm asking is why has it not been done?
Would you both agree that public health research is sorely underfunded?
Yes, not only would I agree with that, but the ex-head of the American Academy of Pediatrics has said that. He said that at a recent IOM meeting, Institute of Medicine meeting, where he said that the amount of money that is spent disproportionately on promoting vaccines is vastly in excess of that's been spent studying vaccine safety. Dr. Lou Cooper.
Dr. Todd, would you agree that research funding for public health issues is not as high as it needs to be?
I would never quibble with that point. We can make a much greater commitment in this country to both public health and to caring for children and finding real answers for children with autism. I think that's absolutely true. On the other hand, the amount of money that's put in to test the safety of vaccines, both pre- and post-marketing, is much greater than probably any other drug or biological product given to anyone in this country. The studies to approve a vaccine require many more patients and much more study and much more rigor than any other drug. And so I think it's very important to emphasize that we have a very strong vaccine safety program in this country. It's much better for vaccines than any other drug.
Now, both of you have mentioned the Cochrane Review Group as a stellar group, but you've mentioned different details about what they've said. I'm sure that you won't mind if, as part of getting this story ready, I call the Cochrane Group and ask them what they're thinking right now about not just vaccinations, but multiple dose vaccinations all given in one group. You don't mind if I do that?
Not at all.
Absolutely. Because they emphasize the importance of weighing all the evidence and not just advocating for theories.
All right. That's an interesting point, Dr. Todd. I did want to mention that while it is the case that evidence-based medicine often does find great insights into how things are working. There's also the example of, I think the man's name was Semmelweis.
Yes, his name was Ignaz Semmelweis.
Do you want to tell that story?
Well, sure. It's a story that I tell often because I'm in the infectious disease area. And so Ignaz Semmelweis in the middle 1800s was an obstetrical doctor at the Allgemeines Krankenhaus in Vienna, which means essentially the general hospital, the all people's hospital. He was aware that many women and their babies were dying of what was called childbed fever. He felt that washing your hands, putting them in what was called chloride of lime, which is like lye water, would perhaps take the germs off the hands. The interesting thing is, he didn't just have that hypothesis, he tested it. He proved without question that it reduced the number of deaths from childbed fever at that hospital. And yet he was ostracized by the doctors who didn't want to embrace that evidence. That was evidence, not an hypothesis.
Well, you know, doctors at that point would be doing autopsies before they went and delivered a child. They had no idea how much they were contributing to the death of the mothers and the children because of what they were doing. They didn't believe the evidence that Dr. Semmelweis had.
That's absolutely correct. They had their feet in the practices of the past, in the concrete of past teaching. Semmelweis had an hypothesis. He tested it. He proved that it was true. And most importantly, it's been verified time and time and time again over decades of people exploring this idea. So even though he was rejected originally, additional studies proved that he was correct.
It took 20 or 30 years before he was exonerated. In that time, he was committed to a mental hospital. He was a cantankerous guy. I think he got beaten to death, finally, is the way that he died. But it took nearly half a century before what he was saying was accepted. It took at least 20 years.
It evolved certainly over time, and yet at exactly the same time in the U.S., Oliver Wendell Holmes was coming to the same conclusion based on epidemiological data in Boston, Massachusetts. It takes time to find out if a new theory is really true and to test it. It takes more time to implement changes in old practices of healthcare. Yet it's those kind of advances with the preponderance of evidence over time that result in major changes in healthcare.
And one new wrinkle in the healthcare field right now is looking at gut and microbial health and how conditions such as inflammation and gut health can tie in with whether somebody's healthy or sick. And Dr. Wakefield, is your primary focus on vaccines or is it on the health of the gut?
Well, it's on both, because I think personally that they're interrelated. And I'm like Dr. Todd, I'm a great advocate of taking theory and putting it to the test. And we've done this recently by looking at the infant vaccine schedule of the 1990s in rhesus macaque infants and comparing that with animals receiving just the saline control. And when we do that, we find changes remarkably similar to those in the brains of children with autism. And that is extremely worrying. But the other opportunity that that gives us is the ability to look at the evolving gut bacteria in these animals and what changes might be taking place in association not only with their neurodevelopmental changes, but also the vaccine schedule. So it's a very rich field, it's very exciting, and I believe that there is an intimate relationship between gut health and the developing brain.
One question that I've had looking at this controversy about vaccinations in children with autism, and in fact a number of different illnesses that children can have, such as asthma, such as bowel problems or digestive problems. It's not just autism that might have a gut link. It made me wonder whether there have been any studies that focus on children who tend to have gut inflammatory issues and what vaccines have as a consequence to those children. The reason that I was wondering is because it's such a huge number of children and people in the United States tested in a large group. Is there any way that we might be overlooking the possibility that something like a vaccine is great for most kids, for most adults, it doesn't have an impact on their health, but there might be a subset where if their inflammatory system, their digestive system is already a little bit out of whack, that all it takes is one little straw to push it over the edge to a place that it shouldn't be, and for some of those children, could it be a vaccine? And I'd like you to answer this first, Dr. Todd.
Well, it's a current area of interest and of research.
We haven't done the epidemiological studies or the extensive research studies where we narrow the field of who we're looking at to what might be a potential group of children who might need a special protocol.
Well, no, that it has been done for known immunodeficiencies. For instance, can you give certain vaccines to kids with leukemia, for instance, or who have a problem, a known problem with their immunity? So no, those things have been looked at to the extent that those groups can be identified. The key issue is, well, what additional groups might one propose? And that's a reasonable question. That should be tested before any change in policy is advocated. But again, to emphasize, for the overall population of children, the evidence is getting the MMR vaccine actually reduces their overall risk of getting autism. And so if somebody wants to propose that, well, maybe that's not true for all of those children, that is something that, by the way, doesn't require, that is not proven by any kind of animal experiment. It needs to ultimately addressed by the epidemiology in that population.
Does animal research sometimes point to a reason to do a human study?
Sometimes it does, but we have to recognize that animal research has often pointed us in the wrong direction as well. If the data are strong enough, it might suggest a well-designed trial to look at a particular population that might be at risk, but it does not imply that we should adopt that as vaccine policy.
Dr. Wakefield.
The World Health Organization actually make recommendations to vaccine manufacturers to conduct primate studies, that is, studies in non-human primates before the vaccines are licensed. So this is not my position, this is the position of the World Health Organization. And when we've done those studies as comprehensively as they should have been done before these vaccine schedules were licensed, we find that there are problems which have not hitherto been picked up. And the question must remain is, had they found those problems when they should have found them, would they have then have licensed the program? And I have major questions about that, whether they would have done or not.
Just to clarify, you're not against the vaccinations that have been suggested for children to have. You're primarily concerned about the fact that they're given in multiple doses. You're not telling people, don't vaccinate your children.
No, I have huge concerns about vaccine safety overall. The safety of vaccines has not been adequately tested. The ingredients that go into vaccines, such as the thimerosal, the mercury-containing preservative that was referred to earlier, was grandfathered in. It was never tested for safety properly. It was grandfathered in. And now we find that, in contrary to the evidence that is put out there by the public relations gurus, in fact, of the 58 studies that have been performed looking at these heavy metals and their association with autism, 73% actually support an association. And that's not my evidence. That comes from Dr. Kathy DeSoto at the University of Northern Iowa. So in fact, the message that's going out there from the public relations department is quite different to that that is associated with the actual scientific facts.
Dr. Todd, you want to respond?
Sure. Kathy DeSoto's paper basically looks at all papers that have addressed this issue. And in her paper, she clearly says there were only 4 papers that really met rigorous standards of study design. As I recall, 3 of the 4 concluded that there was no connection between mercury and autism. She said there were issues with some of those, but they were still the 4 best. And the one most recent, which was the best study, she found no fault with and concluded there was no association. So we shouldn't be talking about numbers of papers. We need to talk, and the Cochrane people emphasize this, about the quality of the evidence. People can go out and do little studies and they can make claims that support their theories. But the bottom line is, what's the quality of the evidence and of all the evidence? And there's just no question that continuing to advocate for this theory is harmful, because if we talk about the safety of vaccines and we start arguing that, well, these kids shouldn't be getting these vaccines because somehow this or that safety issue, no matter how theoretical, hasn't been tested, we then have to talk about what's the safety of not giving them the vaccine. The evidence here in Colorado is very clear. It's clear across the country. If you don't give them the vaccines, there's a risk of getting these diseases, just like happened in the UK after Dr. Wakefield's paper. And you're going to have many children getting these diseases again with all the consequences of that. That's happened in this country even in the last few years.
Now, if I recall from what Dr. Wakefield said, his interpretation of what happened in the United Kingdom is that he had recommended single vaccines. The public health agencies in Great Britain blocked the accessibility to single vaccines, and that resulted in an overall reduction in the number of children vaccinated. I'm not hearing you, Dr. Wakefield, say that overall you would say pull children away and don't vaccinate them.
No, absolutely not. Let me go one step further than that and say that if you stopped measles vaccination now, because mothers who've been vaccinated do not confer good immunity on their children, then infants under the age of one would be susceptible to measles when it came back, and they would be the ones who suffer. So it would be catastrophic not to continue, for example, measles vaccination. And so it's a policy that we need to look at very, very carefully with a basic understanding of what these viruses do, what excipients in vaccines do, what the multiple load of vaccines do, and address that very, very carefully, certainly before putting any other vaccines into the program.
We've talked a lot about vaccines now. I get the impression that we could talk about them for years and still not find all of the answers. But I'm curious about this issue of gut health. There's that question that you raised, Dr. Wakefield. You're wondering about some children who might be more susceptible to multiple vaccinations. Dr. Todd, you say that there's not much evidence for that. But there is evidence for children taking antibiotics and how those affect gut health.
Sure, but my point is this. We shouldn't change policy, which is very effective in safely reducing the incidence of infectious diseases in this country, until that sort of hypothesis has been tested. If, in fact, you can identify a group that you think might be more susceptible to certain kinds of problems because of gut health, that's something that can be tested. Until that happens, however, we should not be talking about changing vaccination policy. We have the safest system for evaluating vaccine safety in the world.
Right now, we have a lot of families that are running scared because there's an increase of autism, especially an increase in the regressive form of autism where a child is fine. And then at a certain age, around the time that children tend to get their major vaccinations, these children regress. They don't speak. The parents can notice brain fog. There can be profound changes in a child at that point and tragic changes. This has many parents frightened. I can't help but wonder if there was more research into some of the physical things that may be happening with a child like that, if we might be able to answer some of these questions better so that parents aren't going to be scared. And if not by Dr. Wakefield, or by the way that the media and public policy responded to Dr. Wakefield, by somebody else who also is scared about these things or concerned and doesn't have answers yet. So we're better off if we find answers. And one place we can look is at this gut health issue. There is documented evidence now that antibiotic use has been overdone. There was a long time where if a child got an earache, doctors readily prescribed antibiotics. It took at least 10 years, maybe two decades, before doctors, through evidence, realized that they were actually increasing the risk of earaches and sinus infections in children because of how many times they were giving them antibiotics for these conditions. There are concerns that the kind of food that children eat today causes dysbiosis in their guts, meaning ways that the gut becomes leaky. It does look like there might be a link between autism and digestive problems. Dr. Wakefield, you're a gastroenterologist.
Yes.
That means you look at digestion.
Yes, I clearly I have a bias because I'm a gastroenterologist and that's the perspective I've come to, but we are what we eat, effectively, and the gut in this sense is much the seat of the soul, that there is a real problem there in many, many children. And whether it's due to inflammation or leakiness or whether it's due to the bacteria behaving badly, whatever it is, there seems to be a common denominator in many, many children with autism, even as far as back as when Leo Kanner first described autism. Many of those children had gastrointestinal problems, and they were rather overlooked as being psychogenic, that this was just the child's reaction to the world. Well, no, it wasn't. In fact, it may well have been the origin of the problem. And I think that if we can address that vigorously, as people are now around the country trying to understand the gut bacteria, the effect of diet, to a recently a very good paper, a controlled, randomized controlled clinical trial from Denmark and the UK, looking at the effect of a gluten casein-free diet and showing clear evidence of benefit over the course of a year.
Now, when you say gluten and casein, you mean foods like wheat that had the gluten protein in them, foods that have dairy in them, which has casein, basically somewhat of a grain-free diet and somewhat of a dairy-free diet.
Yes, when this diet, when done, has to be done perfectly. It has to be 100%, rather like if you had celiac disease and had gluten intolerance.
Or is it like a bee sting? If someone's very allergic to a bee sting, it's not that they can have just a little bit of a bee sting. They need to avoid all of those bee stings.
It seems from clinical experience that, yes, there need to be absolute withdrawal of this of these substances from the diet. How they're working, we don't know. Parents were the first to advocate them, but now science is catching up. And as I say, the first proper randomized clinical control trial showing benefit has just been published.
Is there a possibility that if we explored this gut health link far enough, we might find that if we had healthy guts in children, they could have a lot more vaccinations, even for someone like you who has great concerns about them? Could it be that you might even discover that vaccinations is not the issue as much as gut health is the issue?
Well, I think as Dr. Todd said, theory is okay, but evidence is essential, and I think that it would be a big jump to go from one to the other. I think that advocating for gut health is extremely important, and I would certainly go that far.
But you wouldn't go as far as to say that maybe these vaccinations are more safe than you know?
They're as safe as the evidence tells us they are at the moment. My position on that is obviously very different from Dr. Todd's.
And that difference, just to remind people again, is that you recommend single vaccinations, and Dr. Todd, you say that there's no harm to multiple vaccinations, and it's easier for a family to get them done, so why not?
That's correct. I think we do families a disservice by conflating the issues of gut abnormalities in children with autism with vaccination. They're two different issues, and there's not evidence that they are connected. The fact that autistic children have gut issues is now well accepted, and it's a big issue. The point, however, is there's no credible connection between that and vaccines. The fact that families of autistic children need a lot more information, a lot more science, a lot more help is absolutely true. But the minute we start conflating these and tying them together is, I think, where we're doing them a disservice. And so I think it'd be appropriate to hear about this issue in terms of gut health. And should we be bringing these things together, or should we be looking at this as a very important independent area where we need a lot more information? And I agree, we do.
Well, then let's get an expert on gut health and microbes. And Kathy, can you say again your name and what you do and what you know about gut health and autism?
My name is Kathy Lozapone, and I'm a postdoctoral researcher in the Molecular, Cellular, and Developmental Biology Department at the University of Colorado Boulder. And I study factors that can affect how microbes in your gut differ. I've recently become very interested in this link between autism and the composition of gut bacteria. I want to start off by saying I do agree with Dr. Todd that there has been no demonstrated link between vaccines and gut health, and recent studies looking at links between autism and vaccines have also failed to find evidence of this link with gut health and the MMR vaccine. But there has been a growing body of evidence showing a link between autism and gut health, and this came off from observations of parents that their children have gastrointestinal issues, and this has been shown to be a significant association. Few papers have gone to look at what types of bacteria might differ in children with autism and their siblings and people without autism. Certain types of microbes, mostly in a Clostridia group, have been shown to be in an increased abundance. The hypothesis is that autism could be related to harmful bacteria gaining hold, colonizing the gut, and producing neurotoxins that make it through the intestinal barrier and that can cause autism.
It's one of the areas that you're exploring. You're also looking at the possibility that repeated antibiotic use, so a child who's had a lot of ear infections, may be more susceptible to becoming regressively autistic because their gut microbes change.
That is a very strong hypothesis. I mean, there's a definite link between gut health and antibiotics, and there's not a definite link between gut health and vaccines. Both things have been increasing. Vaccination schedules have been increasing, and antibiotic usage has been increasing. There's been limited research on this issue with antibiotics. There was one paper that suggested that children with autism had ear infections and were treated with an average of something like 12 courses of antibiotics. But it wasn't a controlled study where they looked at normal children. And so I think those controlled studies need to be done for antibiotics.
And Kathy, as we were talking about the possibility that if you have a child whose immune system and gut health are already shaky, that there's a lot of ways that a straw could break the camel's back. And who knows what those straws could be. I saw you nodding your head about that.
Autism it's a complex disease, obviously. There's genetic markers for it as well. It's not just that every child is going to respond the same to, say, multiple rounds of antibiotics. There's also, in terms of the gut, not only evidence for the types of microbes are there, but things like how leaky is the gut, how permeable is it to toxins that those microbes might be producing. It's a complex issue, but I do believe it would only be a subset of children who are susceptible, but there is a demonstrated link between gut health and autism. Antibiotics is definitely worthy of further study.
And that's just a taste of some of the possibilities up ahead by looking at the microbes in the gut, some of the new research that's out there, but we don't have the answers yet.
We definitely don't. There's a lot of advancing technology, such as high-throughput sequencing, where we can characterize these communities in greater depth that was before possible and understand more by looking at their genomes what these different microbes might be doing. And so right now, it's very difficult when you figure out, okay, this type of microbe is up with autistic children. We often don't know what that microbe's properties are. Is it a neurotoxin producer? Is it not? Why might it be up? What sort of environmental variables in the gut might vary its prevalence?
And is the problem that particular microbe, or is that the whole gut has gotten to be out of whack? And so one microbe can come in and be more of a bully when in small numbers, it might be just fine. It might even be healthy. That's a possibility.
That's one thing that makes this a difficult problem to tackle. Research that might further address these questions is to understand what types of neurotoxins might these microbes be producing. For instance, there's been some research looking at urine, at the type of metabolites profiles in urine, showing that autistic children have different metabolites from this bacterial community than children without autism. So that gives you some information which of these compounds that are changing are suspected neurotoxins. And then you can ask, looking at the bacteria, which of these bacteria can you tell might have the ability to produce these toxins? And if we could get a better grasp on that, then you could try to figure out, well, what sort of changes, anything from diet, like a gluten-free, casein-free diet, or perhaps another diet that limited substrates that this harmful bacteria might be using to grow.
In other words, if it limited the kind of food that those bacteria like, so instead of giving it the food it likes to munch on, give the body something else.
Absolutely. Even if you could figure out what they're munching on, that they're actually turning into something that's neurotoxic, if you could reduce that in the diet. Or there's been a recent paper on just this leaky gut syndrome suggesting that GFCF diet.
The gluten-free, casein-free, so that means the basically grain-free, dairy-free diet.
Yes, exactly. People who were on this diet actually had decreased gut permeability. So it could be not that it's affecting the bacteria, but that it's affecting general gut health.
Meaning that the gut doesn't leak as much anymore.
So yes, exactly. So even if this neurotoxin was being produced by the bacteria, if it can't get through the intestine into the blood, then it's not going to be able to get to exert these effects on the brain.
Thank you for explaining, Kathy. And Dr. Wakefield, I'm sure that you still don't agree with the idea that from these other two experts that there's no link between vaccination schedules as they are today and autism.
Well, I think there are two things to say. Is one, I don't know to what extent my colleagues have read the science. I've read it in great detail, and I have taken a critical view of it based upon that reading. A lot of people are happy to pronounce on the science without ever having read it in the first place. And I hope that's not the case here.
Well, you know, Dr. Todd, I've always wondered about vaccines because we're told in the United States that they're safe, and yet it's not like I can go in and tell a doctor, give me all 70 vaccines that there are all at once. I want them all at once and get this over with. I don't go into a doctor and say, give me double, triple doses of this vaccination because I want it to be four times more effective. My guess is that if I did that, I could get pretty sick.
I've never heard anyone say, give me all the vaccines at once.
You know, if these vaccines were entirely safe, then why wouldn't I just be able to go in and say, you know, today I want to get all of the vaccines that are recommended in the United States. Let me get them all at once. And also, oh, how about all of those ones for going to third world countries?
Right.
Why not just get them all at once if they're so safe?
First of all, you wouldn't be able to walk for a week if you got all those shots just because of the number of shots you've gotten. And in fact, some vaccines shouldn't be given together. Within the current schedule, if vaccines are given together, they've been studied together. So the combination vaccines, as an example. The other part of that answer is a number of these vaccines, you need multiple doses spaced a certain time apart to get the full immune response. But mainly, I'd suggest that'd be a lot of shots all at once, and you definitely wouldn't want to go there.
Well, the reason that I was asking that is actually I know in vet science, there has been a rethinking of their vaccination schedules so that the vaccinations are not given as frequently because of the sense that over time with a dog, for instance, the vaccinations can start to clog up the very delicate parts of the kidney that tend to filter out unneeded proteins and filter out some inflammatory responses. And so given the fact that these kind of conditions and more allergic conditions can occur in animals if they've had a lot of vaccines, they're thinking about the couch potato dogs that don't go outside around a lot of infectious agents anymore. Yes, these animals do need vaccinations, but maybe not as many as we thought, and maybe not in the combinations that we thought, because in some cases it causes some unforeseen effects later on in the life of this animal. It's one example of where there's a recognition of the fact that simply giving a foreign protein into the body with something like a vaccine can cause some extra stress on the body, for instance, in the kidneys of these dogs, which can cause it to, if it's susceptible, be a little bit more prone to some health problems.
That could be true in dogs. My daughter-in-law is a veterinarian. I've never heard her comment on that, but that could be true in dogs. And in fact, the history of vaccination in the United States is that certain vaccines have been phased out when we decide that the risk of exposure and disease is less than whatever the consequences of getting that vaccine. Smallpox vaccine is a good example. Switching from the polio live attenuated virus to the inactivated virus is another example. These are decisions that constantly are being considered and made. Now, I'd come back to Dr. Wakefield's question of, well, have people read the science? And the answer is yes. Not only have I read the science, I'm sure Kathy has. In addition, we have scientific bodies like the Institute of Medicine who have been charged with reading all the science, the Cochrane reports we've already mentioned, coming to conclusions about what is proven and what is not. Like the Cochrane said about MMR, there's no credible evidence of a connection of MMR to autism. Other evidence later on even suggests it may reduce the risk of autism. Secondly, the Institute of Medicine has weighed in on this. You need to look at all of the evidence, both the numbers of papers as well as the quality of the study designs, and come to conclusions, and those conclusions evolve. And just like you're saying, there may come a time when we will thankfully be able to get rid of some of these current vaccines. The evidence currently, however, is when people chose not to get the MMR, measles 2 years ago was introduced into California, we travel a lot more. We're more likely to go to places or some friend of ours is and bring back a disease if they're not vaccinated and then expose our unvaccinated children. That's happened multiple times in the last few years in the United States. We should be constantly reevaluating our vaccine schedule. I think that's being done. I think we have an incredibly safe system that we're always trying to improve. I certainly would admit that. As far as vaccine safety is in this country, it's well shown to be very safe. And it's not safe to advocate to not vaccinate children, because then you have the issue of getting the natural disease, which can be much more severe.
Dr. Wakefield, do you advocate not vaccinating children?
No, I don't. And what I do advocate, though, is that we interpret the science properly, and I do not believe it's been interpreted properly. If we do not do that job properly, then it will be left to the courts to decide, and it's a matter of fact that the American Vaccine Court has been settling cases of vaccine-induced autism since the early 90s.
There have not been any vaccination cases which have gone to court, actually.
No, on the contrary, there have. Let me give you three names: Misty Hyatt, Hannah Poling, and Bailey Banks.
And have these been in public court with public decisions afterwards?
These have been in, and I have the transcripts here, and you're very welcome to see them. I was given another transcript coming back to this issue of the gut-brain link. A child being awarded, having received MMR, HIB, and DTP vaccine, undergoing developmental regression on an onset of gastrointestinal symptoms, settled. So these documents are freely available.
Now, in the context of millions of people being vaccinated, to have some situations where there's an adverse reaction, I mean, there's some people that have an adverse reaction to zucchini, and we don't outlaw zucchini.
No one is recommending banning vaccines. That is not the point of this. The point of this is that 90% of American parents, their primary concern, medical health concern, is vaccine safety. That isn't going to go away. I've been in this for 15 years, and it's grown and grown and grown. It's not going away. When I was in this 15 years ago, the idea that there was a brain-bowel link, that there were bowel problems in these children, was laughed at. We were treated like Semmelweis, and now everybody generally accepts it. And yet 15 years ago, no one was talking about it. And people have got to look at that and predict the history of the way this is going to go, because more and more parents are expressing concerns. They're expressing concerns about vaccine safety, and those need to be addressed. And if those concerns are addressed and it exonerates vaccines, that's wonderful. And if not, we need to do something about it.
Is your concern also use of antibiotics? Is it concern about the kind of diets that children have who might be susceptible, diets that may need more rigorous support from their medical community to mean that children and their families are compliant with these diets?
Yes, and this is absolutely, again, something we were talking about 15 years ago, which was rubbished, and that is that antibiotics may play a role in this, that children who receive their vaccines while antibiotics may be at increased risk for some reason. We don't know. The systematic evidence isn't there, but this is the kind of story that was being brought to our door 15 years ago.
Well, you know what, Dr. Todd and Dr. Wakefield, having heard you both and hearing about the differences and the concerns that you have, but also the eminent science that both of you have behind what you do and the goals for healthy children, I just wish both of you could be on the same team.
I think that we do absolutely share a primary concern for the well-being of children. We have a different view of the world on this, particularly from the perspective of vaccines, not from the merits of vaccines or the need for vaccines, but the safety of vaccines, and that is my principal concern.
Are you both scientists enough that if one of your strongly held positions today was proven to be different than you expected, that you would be willing to change your opinion?
Absolutely. We create hypotheses and we test them rigorously. We repeat those studies and others repeat those studies. We don't quote legal cases. We have to look at what's real evidence. And so actually, one of my goals in life is to disprove my original theories. I would think that would be a sign of true intellectual integrity. We're not doing parents a favor by telling them that they should act on this concern about safety of vaccines. It turns out vaccines are incredibly safe, and it is not safe to not give your children vaccines.
I don't actually hear a difference of opinion between the two of you on that. I hear you both agreeing that at this point of time in the world, we need children vaccinated for their health. There's a question in how to do it, whether in multiple doses or in single doses. Dr. Wakefield, you have more questions about whether or not we need to have more rigorous control of the ingredients of vaccinations. Overall, you have not been advocating against vaccines. You want to have more attention to this issue.
Yes. Yes, I do believe that there are a number of ingredients in vaccines that have not been studied properly, including the mercury preservative, including the interaction of that preservative with aluminum hydroxide, which is put in there to boost the immune response. It's now known that one can potentiate adverse reaction of another. So there are many, many things that are of concern. One of them that came up recently was the presence of pig virus DNA in the presence of the rotavirus vaccine. And the first vaccine for that to be found in was withdrawn by the FDA, quite rightly. They then went on to analyse the Merck rotavirus vaccine and found evidence of two different pig viruses in there, one of them being a pathogen, that is a disease-causing organism, in young pigs. And so, both vaccines were then put back on the market. That's an extraordinary decision.
Well, and so you still have issues about vaccines, but beyond the vaccines issue is that issue overall of autism, which is one of the things that fueled this concern around the world to begin with. It would be a good benefit for both of you if we could solve more about autism.
Absolutely. It needs to be done urgently.
And I agree completely. If you look at the impact of this whole controversy on families with autism, it has led to all sorts of cottage kind of therapies and proposals that parents have spent a lot of money on, which have in some cases even caused harm. Parents of children with autism are looking for answers, and we need to invest more money and time and scientific expertise in giving them the help that they need. But we do not do them a service by advancing theories and encouraging them to act upon those theories without proper evidence of value to their children.
Dr. Todd, your emphasis, Dr. Todd, is on the fact that sometimes these cottage ideas cause harm. And yet you also agree that 10, 15 years ago, the idea that there might be a gut autism link was ridiculed in the medical community.
Well, I don't know a history of the gut health issue, other than I know that for a long time, parents with children with autism have recognized that their children have bowel issues. But to then equate that with some reason for not getting vaccines is a real stretch. Yes, we should be listening to parents of children with autism, identifying the problems that they're dealing with, investing more money in good, rigorous research. There is something called the Autism Treatment Network that has been set up in the United States in academic research centers all around the country to properly test these things before people embrace them. That's the whole point. This is the way we went from when I was a resident physician in pediatrics to where we are now with children's cancer. By doing organized, multidisciplinary, multi-institutional collaborative studies in a rigorous way to give children the best possible care that is known now, and then to evaluate improvements on that in a rigorous and scientific way. That's what needs to be done. I think that's what the autism community desperately needs and deserves, and I think we should provide that for them.
Final comments from you, Dr. Wakefield.
I entirely agree. I'm, as an academic gastroenterologist who's published about 150 papers on this and related subjects, I entirely agree on the systematic approach to science. And it's sad that some 15 years after we originally put the idea out there, it is only now that the definitive studies on, for example, the diet are being done. And what happens is in the vacuum that exists when doctors are disbelieving or would like to believe something else, they let parents down and the studies are not done. And so parents have to go off and find their own ways of doing things. That is a sadness. It's a great potential risk in many cases. It does throw up new ideas. But it is, I think, in large part due to the failure of the medical profession to actually act upon the parental insights and do something about them in a timely fashion.
There we are, caught between all of the concerns about health, all of the different ways to approach it, what the established groups will deign to look at, what there's money to look at, all of these different conflicting factors. I still wish that you guys could be on the same team.